Hey there. Welcome to the If Money Were Easy podcast, the show where we teach you how to expand what's possible with your money. We're your hosts, Mary Beth Storjahan
and Neela Hummel,
certified financial planners and co-CEOs of Abacus Wealth Partners. Today on the show, we're going to talk about the unique planning needs of the LGBTQ plus community. But before we jump in, a brief disclosure from our Director of Compliance. This podcast is for educational purposes and is not intended as investment, legal, or tax advice. And the opinion shared is not an opinion of Abacus Wealth Partners. Let's jump in.
So today on the show, we are joined by Christopher Stroop. Christopher Stroop is a certified financial planner for Abacus Wealth Partners, a fee-only firm with a focus on impact and socially responsible investing, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and making financial planning accessible. As a former petroleum engineer in the oil and gas industry, just quick pause, that's pretty badass, Christopher received his MBA from Drexel University, then pivoted into wealth management, where he focuses on LGBTQ plus entrepreneurs and Fortune 500 executives. Christopher was named to the 2021 Investment News Class of 40 Under 40, and this past year, he found himself on the LGBTQ Great Top 100 Game Changers 2022 list, which recognizes 100 inspiring people who are helping to change the game for LGBTQ plus diversity, equity, and inclusion across the global financial services ecosystem. Welcome to the show, Christopher.
Welcome.
Hey, happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
We're so excited.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah, I think this is a really important topic for us to discuss about. So I'm happy we're diving into this as Pride Month arrives.
Yes, conveniently. But not so conveniently, because it's necessary all 12 months of the year, not just
true.
In June.
That's true. Pride 365.
Yes.
So let's dive in. In this topic, we talk about the unique financial planning needs of LGBTQ plus individuals. And I'm sure, like many different categories, all needs are not the same. So maybe give us a little bit of an overview of some of the areas that there is some commonality, where there are unique financial planning considerations for the LGBTQ plus community.
Totally. So let's start with the foundation. We're financial planners, and at the root of everything, the financial planning sort of looks the same in the sense that, you know, we still want to make sure you look at your cash flow, understand your expenses. We want to make sure that you have an estate plan in place, you're reviewing your insurances, all of those. We would recommend that for anyone, whether they're a member of the LGBTQ plus community or, you know, our heterosexual peers. I think one of the areas where you really start to see a difference is estate planning, for instance. Let's talk about the family dynamic. Mm-hmm. For the LGBTQ plus community, not everyone has a really great relationship with the family they were born into. Mm-hmm. I think it's something like 50% of members of the queer community are distant or have no relationship with their family because they came out, their family disowned them for whatever reason. And so I think it's really important to understand under the estate planning element, what is the family? Who is the family? Is it biological? Is it a chosen family, as we like to often think about it? And how do we incorporate that into the legacy planning that we do for our LGBTQ plus clients? That's why it's so important for a lot of them to have their estate documents in order, because if they don't, a lot of the intestate rules will default to the biological family. And if they have a fraught relationship with the members of those family, they may not want any of their assets to go to them.
Right.
So that's one of those areas where it's really critical for our population, for the queer population, to really have their ducks in a row when it comes to financial planning.
So talk to us a little bit about what those documents would be. What are we wanting to make sure that we cover under the umbrella of estate planning? Is it like my healthcare? Is it my assets? What are we looking at?
It's all of that. So first and foremost, starting with a will, making sure you have that documented so you go around any kind of intestate or things that would happen when you didn't have that in order. Other items you want to think about: durable power of attorney. So end of life, having durable power of attorney in place, someone who can take control of your assets, finances, if you're no longer to designate it yourself. Some other things would be just HIPAA authorization, ensuring that, let's say you have a partner, you're not married, but you want to make sure that they have information about you in terms of if you're in the hospital, making sure that that's done. Advanced healthcare directive. What are the wishes that you want if you're incapacitated? Who you want to be making them as your agent? All of these are critical documents to think about having in place as part of your estate document to make sure that you have control in that situation rather than maybe having it to your family that you may not want them to have control in that situation.
Yeah. It's this idea of who are the people that are important to you, because it's not just about who gets what, but it's also who's making control decisions, who's making sure that the bills get paid. And then you even touched on healthcare directives, who is making perhaps end of life decisions. And if you don't have a close relationship with the default that is stipulated by your state, somebody could be making those decisions that you really don't want to be making those decisions.
Exactly. And I think it's even more important when you add family context to that, in sense of your own family. Do you have children with your partner? Who do you want to be the guardian for your child? Ultimately, you want to name all of that in your will as part of your state documents, tie up those loose ends. If you know you have a fraught relationship with your family, that's all critical in terms of the estate planning work that gets done.
I love that you brought up the idea of chosen family. I think it's very often overlooked, even probably in the financial planning community. We really tend to talk about familial relationships that we don't talk about very often, the chosen family and anybody else in your lives, and spending time asking clients, tell us about your family. We never say, tell us about your chosen family.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really interesting perspective that is a good reminder.
Yeah.
Right. I think part of working with the LGBTQ plus community and the planning work that we do is coming to the table and removing all of those expectations or stereotypes or prior definitions that we all have of what does a relationship look like? What does family look like? Because it looks very different for a lot of members of the LGBTQ plus community. And we don't want to come to the table making those preconceived notions that may be way off base.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, estate planning, Mary Beth touched on this. It's such a big umbrella term. And so where else does that implications? Is that beneficiaries? How does life insurance? How do other insurance come into play?
Exactly. I mean, you named beneficiaries. I think that's one of the low hanging fruit that anyone, whether they're a member of the queer community or not, should make sure that if you can name one, someone is named.
Yeah.
And it's an easy way to make sure that assets transfer quickly to the loved one that you want them to go to in case you eventually pass away. Same thing with insurances. You know, all of that is extremely important to review and make sure that you have it in place and that you have the right people named as dependents or as beneficiaries to make sure that your loved ones are taken care of at the end of the day if you're no longer there to provide for them.
Okay. And so we have to talk about the T word meaning taxes. Both Mary Beth and Christopher, they're looking at me like,
I wasn't sure like where we were going.
Like we're going to spill the T word.
Might we be talking about the sexy T?
I thought you were talking about transgender. And I was like, okay.
That would have been more appropriate for branding. Okay. More appropriate.
Taxes in transgender? Is that no?
Okay. No.
Let's not.
So you guys are not inside my head as I make terrible, terrible tax references, unfortunately.
It's okay. We're here for it.
Totally.
So you talk about chosen family, and I've often heard of this idea of should we get married? Should we not get married? And how taxes might come into play. Can you speak about how that might impact the LGBTQ plus community, maybe in a different way?
Yeah, I think now that marriage equality is in place, really the planning question is transferred from how do we protect ourselves because we can't get married to now that we can get married, should we? And one of those is that tax question. Is there a financial benefit or consequence to us getting married in terms of tax consequences? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things to think about in this is that it's a very case-by-case basis. You know, you really want to run the numbers to understand, are we going to be a net positive or a net loss on the situation? For instance, recently ran this calculation for a couple that is currently engaged, no plan yet in terms of the wedding date, but they asked a question, you know, should we do a courthouse wedding this year for tax purposes? And so it was, you know, one of those number crunching calculations where, you know, using our software, are they going to run out ahead federal? How does it apply to state? You don't want to forget about state. Does it apply to local for them? There's a local tax to think about. And it really comes down to how much is the couple earning separately? If there's a large wage disparity between the two partners, then they may benefit from getting married. Just given how the tax brackets double with marriage versus being single, that can really benefit ultimately the higher earner to pay lower in terms of marginal taxes. And then also thinking about what are their deductions? Are they itemizing? Is one just taking the standard deduction? How does that play out? I think really it comes down to speaking with an advisor, speaking with a tax professional to help you understand the numbers at a more finite level, because it's going to be case by case. And for those who are wanting to understand if there's a net positive or not, we can help run those numbers to help them make a informed financial decision if marriage for them is something they want to do because of finances.
See, taxes are so romantic.
I mean,
super
romantic. I mean, I think all I've learned from being a financial planner is that marriage is really just a financial transaction.
Not wrong.
Right.
You know?
It's a significant portion of it.
Totally. Yeah, I think taxes is one of those key considerations of many when it comes to thinking about should we marry, should we not marry, what do we gain, what do we give up?
There's obviously been a lot of progress in terms of marriage equality. Now the hurdle isn't how do we, like, should we? What are the other hurdles that are being faced by this community, the financial considerations beyond estate planning, beyond taxes? What are you looking at when you're talking to clients? What are your clients asking you about that you're noticing?
I think one of those big areas is insurance.
Hmm.
Insurance is slow moving, doesn't catch up with the modern times in terms of just socially where we are at as a country, in terms of culture. I think the insurance area is where we run into a lot of problems still with members of the LGBTQ plus community.
And the transgender community.
And transgender, right? Yeah, totally.
That's included in the T, but yeah, but that I think really hits.
Medical care,
right.
Disability, life insurance. I mean, there's still sort of systemic discrimination. Mm-hmm. For instance, I think about a client, gay man on PrEP. PrEP is a preventative drug in terms of preventing HIV/AIDS, which we know in the 80s and 90s was something that really affected the LGBT plus community. Now there's drugs, I guess, now that help prevent that transmission. And gay men who are taking it can often be seen as high risk to insurance industry in terms of the underwriting process, where I've had clients get denied life insurance or disability insurance, or have had to pay a lot higher premiums because of the industry labeling them as a risk, when the reality is that this is really just a preventative drug. And so we've had to shop around to make sure that we find a provider that doesn't count this against them. And so I think the insurance area is still an element of planning where we run into a lot of hurdles and may take a lot of extra steps that our heterosexual peers don't even think about.
Right. And it's almost like in the best case, you're able to shop around and get fair treatment. But in the worst case, you end up paying increased premiums over a long period of time. That probably has massive ramifications from a wealth building standpoint. That's a financial cost that doesn't need to be borne.
Totally. Exactly. And so I think part of it is just setting the expectation and helping clients understand that, hey, we might face these hurdles and helping them not feel discouraged by this. And part of that is our job as the planner to understand who are our partners in this, in these conversations that we can really turn to, who understand, you know, how to communicate with this client who's a member of the queer community and understand some of their health history that could be affecting them and just how to navigate those conversations delicately to ensure that ultimately we're still finding them the best coverage for their situation.
There's many stereotypes that impact this community. And I wanted to kind of talk about some of those because I think there's still such a generational wealth gap. And I think you can speak to this more than I can, but so often we talk about there's a view of the traditional wealthy gay couple. They have no children. We call them DINK, dual income, no kids. That's what it's called in our industry. And we talk about the spending power they have and what a surplus there must be because there is no children. And that oftentimes gets projected onto the whole community, right? We assume that there must be so much money running around in this cohort because there's no kids. And so speak to that a little bit and what is actually and truly happening in terms of generational wealth and the barriers faced by this community.
Right. I think dual income, no kids, it's just a stereotype. I think in this community, it's the intersectionality of a lot of financial challenges we hear in terms of just race or gender or sexuality. It really all comes together in terms of the LGBTQ plus community. I mean, ultimately, they still earn less than many of their straight counterparts. They still face discrimination in the workplace, even though it's outlawed, it still happens.
Right.
And so I think they have more fraught relationships with their family. So we talk about generational wealth. A lot of generational wealth occurs via the transfer of wealth from the parents to the children. If 50% of the queer community has no relationship with their biological family, that money is not being transferred to them. And so that means that they have to build wealth on their own. And that's a lot harder for the community when you just don't have that extra layer of support. I mean, think about the amount of support that you may help with your children, right? Or how much support your parents provided to you. When that's not an option, that means it's much harder to buy a home. You may graduate with school with a lot more debt. Starting a family becomes way more cost prohibitive. So it really compounds when we think about how it affects the LGBTQ plus community in terms of just building wealth for themselves.
And it sounds like it could also start a lot earlier. If you end up having a fraught relationship, say high school or even before, that means maybe you're getting out and you're starting things on your own. Both you mentioned student loan debt, but just being maybe more self-sufficient earlier than you might otherwise need to be.
That's totally true. I mean, for some people, this wasn't my experience, but as soon as they come out, maybe they come out in their teenage years, family might kick them out. And so, you know, there's a higher number of foster care and youth organizations that identify as LGBTQ plus versus the general population. And that's due to these family dynamics. And so a lot of them could be kicked out at early age and just set back in terms of, you know, how they can think about setting themselves up financially for success in the long run.
We think a lot about one of the best ways to control your financial situation is to increase your earnings. And mm-hmm. I would go out on a limb and say that the LGBTQ plus community probably faces a lot of discrimination in the workplace. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. They still earn less than their straight peers. And so that means that it makes it harder for us to save for retirement, build an emergency reserve, save to buy a home. I mean, all of that plays into slowing down when members of this community might be able to reach some of these goals that we consider the American dream. Starting a family, buying a home, all of this is happening much later for our community than maybe our straight peers.
You mentioned a lot of times the fundamentals can be the same. You want to walk us through some of the fundamentals where these are the things that you need, whether you're in the LGBTQ plus community or not. What does everybody need to make sure that we're hitting those?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, it's understanding what money's coming in versus what money's going out. So looking at your cash flow, if you don't know where the money's going and what you're spending it on, you're going to have a hard time ultimately aligning your money with what's most important to you. And so I think one, understand your cash flow. There's a lot of ways to do that. I mean, I personally love Mint. There's also personal capital. You need a budget. I mean, there's a lot of tools out there that can help anyone just start to see what's under the hood and where's the money going. I think that's really step one. The second step, building an emergency reserve or an emergency fund. I think this is critical for anyone in terms of being able to tackle a curveball that life might throw your way. And so we often say the rule of thumb is 3 to 6 months. I think if you're solo, you might want to think about 6 to 12 months just to give yourself an extra horizon if you were to lose your job or if there was a large emergency that were able to be dropped on your plate. The third, think about retirement savings. I mean, at the end of the day, we all want to probably achieve work optionality at some point. And so that means taking advantage of your employer plan, at least saving enough to get the employer match. Can you save in a Roth? Can you save in a traditional IRA? If you're married, is there a spousal IRA opportunity? You know, we want to focus on retirement because the earlier you start, as we know, you know, you can maximize that compounding interest in terms of the time value of money. And starting in your 20s can have a huge benefit for you when you're 65 versus even starting in your 30s.
And check those beneficiaries. Check those bennies.
Totally. Exactly. It should be a default add is when you sign up for that program. We've talked about this earlier. I think the fourth step is really building your safety net. And so this is what insurance coverages do I need? Whether they're employer-based, am I taking full advantage of the options that are out there for me via my employer, whether it's health insurance, dental, is there group life insurance I could take advantage of, disability insurance? It really comes down to making sure that you have those protections in place for when you need it, because ultimately we're all going to need to leverage insurance at some point. And so making sure you're taking advantage of that. And then the last one is protecting your legacy. We talked about the importance of estate planning, and that is extremely important for anyone, but especially the LGBTQ plus community that may not have the same familial relationship that our straight peers may have. And so making sure you have a will in place, prioritizing end-of-life care, power of attorney, advanced healthcare directive, HIPAA authorization, tying loose ends up with any children that you may have. All of that is sort of key is in terms of underpinning the estate planning work that anyone should really have in place.
Yeah. One of the unique goals that I know that we've planned for with the LGBTQ plus community I have in the past is family planning and the unique costs that can come along with that in terms of adoption, fertility, et cetera. And how do you talk to clients about that goal? If it is appropriate for them or it is something that's on their list, how do you help them to plan for that or navigate around that?
Yeah, I think to that point, 77% of millennials either have children or want to have children, members of the LGBT plus community. So this is only going to be more of a discussion with clients moving forward, including myself. And so I think it really comes down to understanding what do they want their family to look like and how do they want to navigate the option? Because there's a number of pathways in terms of family planning. And so first and foremost, do you want to adopt versus do you want to have a child that is maybe of your own legacy? I think that's really, you know, how do you what do you want that to look like?
And that's just like yes or no on children. Then yes, this goes here. And then the flow chart.
I hate to say it's a flow chart because this is planning for a family, but it sort of is in terms of is having a child of your own legacy important or do you want to be a foster parent? Because the cost there, your answer to that question depends on how much this is going to cost. Let's say you want to foster, it could range from virtually free to a few thousand dollars if you do state foster and have state assistance to, you know, upwards of $50,000, $60,000 in terms of adoption. If you decide to do an international adoption, you know, it ranges anywhere in there, depending on the kind of adoption you want. And it's key to recognize that members of the LGBTQ plus community also face discrimination in that foster pathway, right? There are some countries that will not adopt to me because I'm a gay man and they don't see me as a parent. And so that's something that you got to help a client navigate in terms of if they do an independent adoption and decide to take the burden on their own to navigate the adoption process, or do they work with an agency and finding an agency that understands how to work with queer parents and help them navigate those intricacies. If they decide to not go with fostering and have a family through surrogacy and IVF, I mean, you could be looking at $250,000 in terms of the full cost of having the surrogacy, the different rounds of IVF. If things all go well the first time, like that is a down payment on home.
Yeah.
And that's just to have a child. That doesn't include all the costs that we know that come.
It's about $300,000 to raise to age 18, yep. I believe.
Exactly. So, you know, it's really key to just help clients understand it's not just a one-time cost of like, yay, the child is here. It's how does it fit into the context of their overall financial plan? And some of the modeling work that we do in terms of just how do we make this work for you? Because you said starting a family is really important. So where are you at now in relation to that goal? What levers do we need to pull over the maybe next 2, 3, 5 years to help ensure that you are in a financially sound position to, you know, raise this beautiful child that you want to have?
Right. This idea of bringing intentionality into it. I remember talking to one of my friends a few years ago and her saying, there's no whoops in terms of family planning for me and my wife. She's like, our family planning starts with us sitting around a kitchen table with spreadsheets and yellow pads. It's a different prospect. And so just being more intentional about it. And then what I'm also hearing from you is just asking the right questions. What does it look like? Because what it might look like could be very different depending on which route you pick.
Totally. Totally. And I think that's part of our job as the advisor is to really bring that out with the client and just show them the options.
Right.
They don't know what they don't know. And part of it is connecting with the right resources or just helping them understand, okay, again, running the numbers, you know, having a child is a financial decision.
Right.
And so what does that look like for you in the short term, in the long term? You know, are you willing to work a couple extra years if that's what it takes for you to start the family that you want to have?
And it is so hard with fertility treatments because there is no guarantee, right? And so that is like, what's your cap?
Right.
Or are you willing to work longer? Like, what are the levers that you're able to pull or willing to pull when you get to like the second round of IVF and it hasn't worked or you need the next donor? Where are you going? And I think that is a unique situation. And I'd say it's a combination of financial, physical, and emotional all in one for this family, depending on which path you take, you know, because adoption comes with so much more, and fostering especially, so much more emotional. Maybe the financial isn't necessarily there, but there are some real interesting things that happen on that side too, where you could be with a child and then the parents could come back into the picture. And so that's like a different emotional roller coaster versus private adoption and fertility. So it's such a unique position that we're in as advisors to be able to consult with clients through those kind of life decisions.
Totally. Yep. Because at the end of the day, it's just their journey, right? And so part of our job is just to be that guide for them and to help them make the smartest financial decision.
Yeah. Well, before we wrap, are there any other concerns or considerations that come to mind that we should be sharing with our listeners in terms of working with this community?
I think really just find an advisor that meets you where you're at. And in terms of finding an advisor, whether they're an ally or a member of the community themselves, I think having these money conversations is critical, and we don't have enough of them for our community. And so I think if you can find yourself a partner who celebrates you, sees you where you're at, and can just be able to speak your language and understand your story, because maybe they've been there themselves, that can be really powerful for you as you think about building on your financial journey and ultimately achieving your goals in the long run.
Love it. Well, let's pivot to our closing questions, sir. Thank you so much. So our final three questions, we'll start with our first. What is the best financial advice you ever received?
You know, when I was thinking about this question, I was thinking, okay, what are key moments of my working life in terms of that were financially an inflection point? And the one that came to mind was my first internship when I was working for Chevron in Houston, Texas, my sophomore year of college. One of the petroleum engineers, his name was Bill, pulled me aside one day and showed me my pay stub and in our 401k. And as an intern, we had the option to defer into Chevron's 401k. And I remember him just walking me through, here's what the 401k is. You should really contribute to this, at least get the company match at minimum. And I can just remember that conversation happening and contributing to a 401k as an intern and thinking the importance of maximizing that as I move forward. And I think that always stuck with me in terms of just maximizing your employer benefit, saving for the long term, and trying to save early so that you can have more options down the road. And I thank Bill for sort of pulling me aside as someone who knew nothing about personal finance at that time, or probably what a 401k was, to sort of set me on a path of being a saver in that regard.
Raising our hands to all the Bills of the world. Keep yes. keep doing
yeah,
you.
Right. Totally.
All right. What would you say is your favorite money mistake you've made and why?
When I moved to California, I was dead set on buying a Jeep Wrangler. And so this is after college. I bought a brand new Jeep Wrangler, 2014 Sahara granite hardtop. And it was
but like, how cool did you look?
It was like,
how cool did you
super look? Cool. Super cool. Because I was just like living my California dream, right? I thought, oh, this is going to be the perfect car for sunny California. I like go on adventures. It cost about $40,000. I was probably spending $850 a month on my car payment. And it just felt really cool. And then fast forward probably 2 years later, I'm like, why am I paying for this? I ultimately traded it in for a Volkswagen Passat, which I called my dad vehicle, that was used, way more affordable, and I, you know, paid it off much faster. And I look at that Jeep purchase as a mistake, but a learning opportunity of like, what do I need versus what do I want? And how do I reconcile those two things in terms of the long run and opening more doors up financially? And so I look back at that Jeep fondly. I still think about it. I live a carless life here in Los Angeles now, which is a huge turn from those days. But I look at that vehicle and think, yes, it was a money mistake, but I look back on it like it's one of those early learning moments in my adulthood.
That's a good one. Also, Christopher just said he lives a carless lifestyle in Los Angeles. I just need to put an exclamation point on that. That is very, very impressive. So kudos to Christopher.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Final question. Fill in the blank. If money were easy,
I'd spend a lot less time looking at my mint and a lot more time embracing just the simple pleasures in life and the experiences of my day to day.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Well, Christopher, thank you so much for joining us on the show. Let our listeners know how they can get in touch with you and where they can find you on the interwebs.
First and foremost, I'm very active on LinkedIn. So do not hesitate to connect with me on LinkedIn, reach out, send me a request. I'm always happy to be a resource. You can also find me on the Abacus website. You'll see my bio, so don't hesitate to reach out to me through there. Or you can find me on Instagram I share a lot of personal, professional on Instagram. I'm pretty open, so don't hesitate to reach out to me there. My alias is at Christopher L. Stroop, and you'll find me there.
Amazing.
Thank you so much for being on the show. This is a wonderful conversation.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Most people have formed helpful and harmful habits around spending, giving, and investing. Head to abacuswealth.com/quiz to take our financial architect quiz and learn your three dominant money types. You'll receive personalized guidance that helps you have a healthier, more balanced relationship to money.